I'm talking today with Rabbi Rafi Kaiserbluth, and one of the ideas that we discussed what we might cover is, of course, something called kashrut, kosher. What does it mean?
So the word kosher literally means fit, and the idea is that it is describing things that are fit for use, in this case, eating, versus things that are not designated for eating. And it stems out of the Bible. In the various different places, there's some very basic, very general regulations put forth there. One of them is the lists of animals that we are allowed to consume and those we are not. And also a very odd verse that is repeated three times, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. And that really is, from the Bible's perspective, the only thing we know about what it is that we are supposed to eat and not.
Now, which part of the Bible is this?
The Torah, the first five books of Moses.
So around about
really
Moses.
In Leviticus and Numbers is where this is. Okay. And there are two categories of laws. Well, there's many different ways to break down the laws, but in this case, what I'm referring to is there are laws that have an obvious purpose, an obvious meaning, and a very easy way to understand that. For example, don't murder or don't steal. Doesn't take a great scholar to understand why or what the reason is for that. But then there are other categories of laws, and we call that chok in Hebrew. We don't know what the reason is for that command, that law. Generations of scholars have gone through and attempted to give their version, their understanding of it. For example, don't have mixed linens is one of the commands. Or in this case, keeping kosher. Many scholars have given various different reasons. It's healthier. It's a social reason because eating at its most basic is a very social thing. Many cultures spend time together. That is their time for socializing. They're out during the day working, but they sit down for a meal and that's where they catch up and spend time together. And so the theory then is that it was an idea to keep Jews together, socializing together and not with others, not with outside their group. But the evolution of Judaism is such that laws have been added to, or regulations, or as one of my professors in seminary said, a fence around the law to prevent any kind of hint of violating this command.
You say any kind of hint. What are you getting at here?
What am I getting at here? So I'll give you an example that has nothing to do with kashrut, and then we'll come back to that. So for us, Shabbat starts at sundown on Friday afternoon or evening. The rabbis have instituted this idea that it actually starts 18 minutes before the sundown. Because if you don't want to have a problem where you forgot the time, because it's very easy to lose 18 minutes, 20 minutes. So you add 18 minutes and it starts before then. That's a fence around the law. So you're not even attempting to come close to, because for us, the idea of Shabbat is, according to the Bible, is punishable by death if you violate the Shabbat. In this case, when we're talking about kashrut, what does it tell us about in the Bible? It says there are certain categories of animals that you can eat. For example, mammals have to have a split hoof and chew their cud. So cows, sheep, goats, no problem. A pig, definitely not. That is a sine qua non of non-kosher animals. Horse, camel, those sorts of things, which look like perhaps in certain cases, but in actuality, they don't satisfy both of those characteristics.
The characteristics, again, being the split hoof
and chews its cud. That's a mammal. Anything that comes out of the water has to have fins and scales. So salmon, cod, plaice, no problems. Lobster, clams, any shellfish, not allowed. Shark, also has fins but doesn't have scales.
Okay.
And then there's a list only of birds. It doesn't give the characteristics, it just gives a list of birds. And we can infer why those birds are not allowed. Almost all of them are either scavengers or birds of prey. But it doesn't actually explicitly state that. So chicken, no problem. An eagle, not allowed. Why is it that we need to do this? Why do we need to separate what we can and can't eat? Now, the first distinction I want to make very clear is that it's not about better or not better. This is simply a designation that God has commanded that we eat this, but not that, which is not to say this is better than that. It's just this is what is designated and that's not designated. The question then is, why do we do this? As with most students or children or people in general, I suppose, giving the reason is as simply do it because I said so is not only not satisfying, but it also doesn't instill a sense of motivating the person to want to do it. I've seen this with my son. I see it with my students. And I remember a time when I was that age and still today. Why? That doesn't make sense to me. Why do I want to? Mm-hmm. So there's been this basic human need in many Jewish communities to try and understand why we need to keep these laws.
But is that you're trying to understand the mind of God, or are you trying to understand what the text says? Are you looking at the possibility?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. We want to understand understand what would be the purpose for God to command us to do this. Okay. And following that, why do I still need to follow this law? One could very easily make the argument, well, this is something that was commanded several thousand years ago. It's somewhat archaic. It has no place in the modern world. I can eat what I want to eat.
But also, if you were a nomadic people wandering in the desert, there were certainly, it wasn't a good idea to eat certain meat that was out of date or
Correct, absolutely.
It could be extremely dangerous.
So there are these this common thread about it being for health reasons that pig, for example, ham, is a much higher incidence of parasites versus beef or sheep. The problem with that line of reasoning is not that it's not true from a scientific basis. It's simply, if that's the case, that I only eat kosher because it's healthier, what happens when we have today where, by and large, the meat that I purchase from the supermarket is controlled, it is safe, I know what I'm getting, I don't have to worry about it being quote-unquote unhealthy. Does that mean, therefore, I don't have to keep kosher anymore because the underlying reason of it being healthier no longer applies? Mm-hmm. Therefore, I find it very difficult to put a reason in that could eventually be superseded.
But doesn't that mean you're coming back to saying, well, you're not doing it because you were told not to?
No, I've just come up with a different reason for myself. Okay. Also, just because an animal has these characteristics, it also needs to be slaughtered in the proper way. A mammal and a bird needs to be killed very quickly with an extremely sharp knife in one incision to minimize the suffering of the animal. And that's not having anything to do necessarily with the laws of keeping kosher. That would be the consumption. That is also in the collection of laws that we have towards animals. That, yes, we have from the Bible, it says we have dominion over them, but it also says several places we can't mistreat them and we can't cause undue suffering. We are not allowed to torture an animal. We're not allowed to overwork an animal. We are not allowed to, for example, on Saturdays when we're not supposed to do work, we still must milk the cows because to not do so for one day would cause incredible pain. The process of slaughtering an animal is with an extremely sharp knife, one incision, then the blood is drained very quickly, and the animal is, it's difficult to describe this as humane because you're still taking a life, but it is done in such a way that it is minimizing that. In this day and age with the industrialization of food, it's very hard to understand what that would mean, because back when these laws were being promulgated, you didn't necessarily have as much protein in your diet as you do today. You could very easily today have protein, beef or meat or fish every day. That probably wasn't the case. And also, not like today, we are very divorced from the production of food. So these laws were meant to be a way of keeping you in balance and keeping a sense of holiness with the process of your food production, that it is still an animal, it's still a life that you are taking, and you need to bear that in mind. So the production of the food starts with and actually one must be aware of how the animal is raised, so it's not mistreated, but also then the process of slaughtering it. If the animal is blemished or is sick or has a broken leg or anything like that, it's not fit for use. Let's get to the reasoning, because I think that's what you really want to know. So many of these laws come from the book in Leviticus, in Vayikra, we call it, of the holiness code, it's called. And there's a line there that says, Kedoshim tihiyu, you should be holy. This is God speaking. You should be holy. Why? Because I'm the Lord your God, I'm holy. And the idea is we're supposed to emulate God. And from this, I can infer, what is the purpose of my being here on earth? It's to bring holiness into the world. Let's define that term for a moment, because we use that term quite liberally, but do we actually know what it means? If I would ask you, to put you on the spot, what do you think it means?
I have absolutely no idea, not being a fellow of any of the religions we've been discussing.
Many of us, we know what it is, but we can't define it. I really like, it's a very simple definition of holiness. It is simply something set aside for something special, for exclusive use of something special. I sanctify or I make holy my relationship with my wife when we get married. We set aside each other for the exclusive use of ourselves. In much the same way that I set aside the use of a church or a synagogue or a mosque, that's a holy space, we set it aside for the use of something special. Back when they were offering sacrifices, you have two cows or two goats. One was sanctified for the use in the temple service. The other one was left to eat normally. What's the difference between the two? Nothing. They're exactly the same, except one is set aside for something special. So this idea that I'm supposed to bring this sense of elevating something mundane to something holy. Holy and mundane are opposites, and it's not better or worse. Again, it's just simply, this has a specific function, this has a different function. And so if my function is to bring holiness into the world, how do I do that? And it's not, by the way, just when I'm praying or just when I'm being Jewish, when the rest of my life I'm not. The idea of being Jewish is that it infuses every part of your life. Our code of law is called halakha, which means the way or the path. And it includes every single aspect of my life, from praying to eating to marital relations to business to interacting with people, speech, everything. The idea is I'm supposed to bring holiness into everything that I do. How do I do that? One of the most basic functions of any organism on this planet is eating. You can't name for me any organism that is alive that doesn't consume something. I am then tasked with bringing holiness into the world. How do I do that with food? How do I make holy something that is the very definition of mundane, that everything does, eats? And I think this is where the reasoning comes, is that I am supposed to elevate that most basic of function. And by doing that, I say, I'm going to think, I'm going to ponder what it is that I'm putting into my body. I'm not going to just simply consume anything wantonly, whatever I would like. I'm going to put boundaries. The essence of human holiness and a relationship is boundaries. It's discipline. I am going to put limits on what I will eat and what I won't eat. And therefore, that act, that mundane act of eating, has now become holy. And so we as Jews, before we eat, we say a blessing, and after we eat, we do as well, to sanctify, to make holy that most basic of functions. And that, I think, is the basis of the laws of keeping kosher. They're fit for use to make this act of what I'm about to do holy. And so then, if I can make this most mundane of acts, if I can make that holy, there's no limit to what I can make holy.
And we're going to talk on another time about the different types of Judaism, if I can use that word for the moment. And you are aware, as I am, that there are Jews who do not keep kosher household. Are they considered to be beyond the pale?
No. And remember I said, it doesn't make me better, because it's not better or worse. It's a different purpose.
Yeah.
And so I do not think at any point that I am better than anybody else just because I happen to keep these laws.
Yeah, it's your decision based on your understanding, based upon and the laws that you believe you follow.
Exactly right.
What happens when you fail? Because every religion aspires.
Yes.
And then fails. I mean, individuals.
The answer that I like to give the kids, just to make sure if they're paying attention, is that, you know, you get struck by lightning outside. But that's, obviously, it's a joke. That's not at all what we believe. This idea is that you're aspiring to, but you're also human. And so you do make mistakes. So there is a process of atonement. And there's different categories and processes for how you would seek atonement. If it's a sin or transgression between me and somebody else, there's a specific process. But the behavior that you have, that contract you have between you and God, that covenantal relationship, that is only adjudicated and only judged by God.
So when you know you've failed to achieve something that you think is, that you could have done better, put it crudely, simplistically, that between you and your God, you can resolve that one.
You can resolve
that
either.
You don't have to go to a third party?
You don't. If it's between you and God, it's very clearly should be judged only by God. Too often us as human beings, we like to judge other people, but that category of behavior is clearly in the providence of God and only.
If the issue is between two people, then you have ways of reconciling or resolving that issue.
And God is part of that process as well. But the idea, and it's unique with kashrut, I suppose, is that because we are a community or a religion of faith predicated on the community, that's one, and you can very easily see the reasons for wanting to keep these laws. But my understanding of it, and I really chafe at the definition or the reason given, is that it's supposed to keep us apart from others, is I really don't like defining things by the negative. For me, it would seem more accurate that it would be something that keeps us together, not that excludes other people. And so I know in my travels in quite a few countries and continents, I always have a built-in network as far as I find a Jewish community. I come to a Shabbat home on the Friday evening. I know I can have a Shabbat dinner with people who will accept me. And they, when people come traveling through here, same thing goes. And so it's a beautiful notion that it has survived over this many thousands of years. Yes, it has absolutely changed in many different incarnations and over time. The way that we keep kosher today is absolutely not the way they would have done, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago or even further. And I can guarantee you the way we keep kosher today is not the way it's going to be in a few hundred years.
Well, how do you define these changes? What sort of
these changes? So I was just remarking to my father the other day, we just finished Passover. So we have normally, well, not normally, I have two different sets of dishes normally in my home. I have a meat set and a dairy set. And again, that goes back to that verse, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, has come to mean, we've interpreted to mean, that we do not consume meat and dairy in the same meal. So you can have a burger, you can have cheese, but you can't have cheese and burger at the same time. So to minimize or eliminate the possibility that that would happen, you have now has evolved to have different sets of dishes, mm-hmm. meat and dairy. And when Passover comes, we have then another set of two dishes because we're also not supposed to have leavened products on Passover. So we have our regular meat and dairy for the whole year. And then during Passover, we have meat and dairy that is not touched with leavened products. Mm-hmm. So yes, it demands a certain financial, I suppose, commitment, but it also demands a certain spatial commitment. You need to have the storage space for these things. And the way that I do this, I mean, and it's with all of these, it's more of I've decided to live my life not by having my life define my priorities, but the reverse. I define my priorities and then my life has to fit into that. My wife and I have decided this is the way we'd like to live. So we make sacrifices and choices, and this is how we want to do it. And Jews all across the spectrum of all the different flavors and denominations will find different ways of making this system work for them.
Okay, but we were asking, well, how will it change?
How will it change? I can give you a good example. In the States, there is now a kosher certification on products that they want to put that is not simply about the way the meat was slaughtered and prepared. They want to include the entire process of how the animal was treated and how the workers were treated and were they paid on time? Would they live in sanitary conditions?
And this is new. This is
a relatively new thing. And it's amalgamating a corpus of Jewish law and tagging that into a larger process. The idea is you can't be pious only in certain aspects. So you can be very strict with how the meat is slaughtered and then butchered and prepared, but how do you then jibe that with what we know about the food production industry? Animals are in feedlots, stuffed with antibiotics, and they're very sick. The workers are illegal immigrants for the most part, treated very badly, no safety standards. How can I forget about as a Jew, as a human being, how can I accept that? And the only way that is going to change is if we, as the consumer, have some say and vote with our wallet. And so there's an idea that this is now going to be one of the standards, the criteria for certifying something as kosher. It's not simply that the animal was slaughtered properly and butchered properly and packaged. The entire production process has to be a holy process. Barring that, we won't buy it. So this is one way I think will change.
It's interesting because where you've gone into is where I would like to talk further, but we're running out of time, so we can't today. But I want to come back to this idea you've mentioned it a few times of that Jews are here as almost witness to the world. You're bringing some evidence to the world.
We are living in the best way possible to understand and live the will of God. Yeah. And that changes over time, how we understand that. But we do our best effort in a changing world to still make sure that we live according to the will of God. Yeah. So in another way, we would say we're light unto the nations, that we are bringing holiness into the world, not trying to convert them, but trying to make sure that we, all of us, live in an ethical, moral way. That is not the province of only the Jews. All of us can live. We just have that special relationship.
Yeah, we'll discuss that when we have the three of you together. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.